Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, we'll meet indie pop musician Ingrid Michaelson, whose songs are staples on TV commercials and shows like Grey's Anatomy. We'll talk to her about getting beyond the sellout stereotype. And another famous voice you've heard but can't quite place, Tom Kane, the voiceover artist behind more than 30,000 movie trailers, documentaries, and even the Oscars.
Live from the Kodak Theater at Hollywood and Highland in Los Angeles, California.
But we'll begin with a bit of good news for those not inclined to be go-getters or opportunity jumpers or seizers of days. John Perry is an emeritus professor of philosophy at Stanford and a chronic procrastinator. In fact, he wrote his book, The Art of Procrastination, to avoid doing something else. John's theory of structured procrastination won the Ig Nobel Prize, and he's co-host of the public radio show Philosophy Talks. So apparently he gets around to things eventually. John, great to talk with you.
Well, I'm happy to be here, Virginia.
So you're a philosopher, taught philosophy for decades. I wondered if philosophy as a field is a good choice for procrastinators.
Well, probably so. Academia in general, at least the humanities side of it, is not too demanding in terms of deadlines. If you show up 3 minutes late for your class, the students don't usually complain because they're usually 2 minutes late themselves. So compared to broadcasting, your field, now people are not really very forgiving about being 3 minutes late or even 3 seconds late in broadcasting.
Well, I wondered about that because you are also the co-host of the public radio show Philosophy Talks. Now, we know that runs on radio time. How do you get that done?
Well, a procrastinator, if he's going to succeed in such a field, has to make allies with non-procrastinators who can keep him on time and deal with things if he's late. So I partner up with a lot of good non-procrastinators.
But you also write in the book about, you know, non-procrastinators kind of being a little irritating.
Procrastinators can be irritating to non-procrastinators and vice versa, but since procrastinators really need the help of non-procrastinators to keep themselves productive online and not miss appointments, they need to learn not to be annoying. And so I've got a little bit about that. The main thing is not to deny that you're a procrastinator, not to pretend that you're really just in tune with the more important things in the world, which is the reason you never meet the deadlines.
Which is so interesting. Your theory is about structured procrastination, that we can actually get a lot done by not getting other things done. Help us understand this theory.
To be a procrastinator is not necessarily to be lazy. And in a matter of fact, a lot of procrastinators are not lazy, and they've accomplished a great deal. I think if you went through history and took out all the novels and the plays and the poems and the inventions that people came up with while they were supposed to be doing something else, you would impoverish our culture a great deal. So being a procrastinator is not necessarily to be lazy, and that's structured procrastination. You do a lot. You just don't do what you're supposed to be doing. You do a lot as a way of not doing what you're supposed to be doing. I'm not recommending that, but if you find that that's what you are, you shouldn't feel too bad about it. You're not a child molester. You're not a serial killer. You're just somebody who works a little bit strange.
I found that for me, sometimes it's harder not to do something than just to do it. I mean, the sort of, let's say, the psychological guillotine hanging over my head of what I'm supposed to be doing, it takes so much energy to avoid that, that it would be more easier to actually do the deed. Now, is there a right or a wrong way to procrastinate?
Well, the wrong way to procrastinate is try to narrow your things you need to do down to just one, because then instead of doing that one thing, you'll probably just lie on the couch and be completely useless. I mean, if you procrastinate, it's because you lack willpower. You can't do something just because it's the best thing for you to do. Now, you sound like you're not too much of a procrastinator to me.
It comes and goes. But, you know, this is something that you pointed out. Procrastination is often a sort of secretive thing. You know, last night I was supposed to be writing an interview. Mm-hmm. I cleaned my espresso machine, did a lot of dishes, some laundry, you know.
Well, my guess is you'll get the interview written on time. It'll be just fine. In addition, you'll have the laundry done and clean dishes. So you're a productive procrastinator. But sometimes you can't procrastinate or you'll miss a deadline. And then it's important to manipulate yourself. Maybe put a lot of reminders on your email, set up an alarm clock to stop you from dithering away, get your friends to help you. So if you're a procrastinator, you have to accommodate to reality to some extent.
You also had a great chapter on to-do lists that really hit home for me. Give us some advice on putting together a to-do list.
Well, the main thing about your daily to-do list is it's not really a reminder of what to do because probably you know what you should do. It's a way of giving yourself a pat on the back by crossing things off your to-do list. At least that's the way I look at it. It's important to break your to-do list into small components. Don't just put clean the garage, but go out into the garage, look at the garage, think about the garage. Clean up that first shelf to the right of the door. Then you'll, as you check those things off, either on an actual to-do list or mentally, you'll get up ahead of steam. It's also important to put things not to do on your to-do list. If you're a procrastinator, then if you figure out your list ahead of time, you know what kind of things will distract you and just put down there, don't do them.
Mm-hmm.
May not sound like much, but it'll help.
Okay, so one of your motivating tools is finding the right music to start the day. I understand you're a fan of Neil Diamond.
Well, I like Neil Diamond because, well, I think he's a great singer and a great songwriter, but a lot of his music, like America, is really the kind of thing that gets you pepped up and going.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, in the morning, when you get up, if you're a little depressed like a lot of procrastinators are in the morning, you really don't want to hear Neil Diamond. You want to hear Johnny Cash sing Hurt or, you know, somebody sing about whiskey and women. So the thing is, you got to choose your songs the night before. That's self-manipulation. The guy the night before doesn't really want you to get back into bed. And so you can count on him to set up a song list that'll make you peppy, even if when you hear those songs in the morning, you may want to throw up.
Well, I hate to set you up on this because we have very little time, so you're just going to have to answer. Do you feel like readers get some relief from the fact that you, a Stanford professor, radio co-host, suffer from the same problem as so many others? I mean, is there room for a support group here for procrastinators?
Yeah, sort of. I was thinking of it as a 12-step program, but I could only come up with 3 steps. But basically, my email indicates that a lot of people resonate with this, and that I felt very good about doing something that's a little bit helpful to people.
I'm so glad you got around to it, John.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, Virginia.
John Perry, Professor Emeritus at Stanford University. He's also a winner of the Ig Nobel Prize and co-host of the public radio show Philosophy Talks. We do have more on his book, The Art of Procrastination, A Guide to Effective Dawdling, Lollygagging, and Postponing. We encourage you to put off whatever more important thing you're doing and read about him at wordofmouthradio.org. There's no room for lollygagging in high fashion, that alternate universe where the new and fabulous can look old and dated in just a season. We recently discovered one trend that's both fast-moving and more practical than 5-inch heels, fashion trucks. Producer Britta Conroy-Randall chased down a mobile boutique for the story.
Emily Benson had always dreamed of opening a clothing store, but her biggest fear, that she'd choose the wrong location, had stalled her plans.
What if I pick the wrong spot? And what if I'm locked into that spot? And what if no one comes to that spot?
So she opened a store that she can move if the mood takes her. Now she gasses her store up and drives it to wherever the shoppers are. Benson says that she was inspired by the food trucks that have become so popular around the country in the past few years.
It just seemed like they were taking restaurants to this whole new level where you could experience what they had to offer in a more casual way. You know, I really like the way there's a food truck right here pulling up next to us. And, you know, they're just finding a place to park. They see a lot of people outside and they figure, you know what, we're going to offer our food to just these people walking by.
As a result of the recession and the unstable recovery, lots of first-time business owners have been unable or unwilling to commit to the monthly overheads involved in a traditional store. Stacey Steffi, who owns a fashion truck in LA, says a brick-and-mortar store can be pretty pricey. When she started looking into rents, she says it almost turned her off retail for good.
One of the spaces I had looked into, in order to just get into the spot, they wanted $15,000 up front. And then after that, it was going to be $5,000 a month for the next 5 years. And that was almost just, that was scary.
It's costs like these that drove Emily Benson to come up with the idea for the fashion truck. But she says she treats the business side of things exactly the same as a regular boutique. And she's made an effort to make the truck look that way too.
You don't feel like you're in a truck at all. I think a lot of people walk in and are very confused at first that they're even in a truck.
One thing that is different to a regular store is that she moves around constantly. Benson says she makes use of social media like Twitter, Facebook and Instagram to let people know where she's going to be. Plus, old-fashioned word of mouth helps too.
People find me, and if they don't find me, they're doing something wrong.
Benson says the response she's received from shoppers is encouraging. She says a lot of people just don't get the concept at first, but she has a way of explaining it to newcomers.
Well, you know food trucks. I'm a fashion truck. I'm the fashion truck.
And without fail, the very next question she gets?
How do you get a permit to do this?
Benson says the permits are what's holding the new trend back.
In Massachusetts, we have something called a hawkers and peddlers license. It was created like in the 1800s and last updated in 1973. So it really doesn't include things like what I do. So I've kind of jetted around the rules.
Benson's been working with the Boston City Council to make sure she stays within the city's out-of-date guidelines. But she hopes that soon the rules will catch up to her. Right now, there are around 65 mobile retailers in the country, but Stacey Steffi in LA says it's just a matter of time until fashion trucks become as common as the food trucks that inspired them. She says she's even been hearing from traditional shop owners about turning mobile.
Today I just got an email from somebody. She's been in business since the 1940s with her store, and she wants to go into mobile retail because her business is suffering and she knows she needs to take it to the next level. This is just a new industry. We're just going to grow more and more.
For Word of Mouth, I'm Britta Conroy-Randall.
Coming up, defecting from a diagnosis. A grown-up realizes that the Asperger's label given to him as a teen was actually typical adolescent isolation. When Word of Mouth continues.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The mysterious neurological condition known as Asperger's syndrome may soon be history. Proposals for the upcoming fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM-5, recommends filing Asperger's under the general category of autism spectrum disorder. For those already diagnosed, the change would alter or at least complicate a part of their identity. Benjamin Nugent's diagnosis of Asperger's was taken away for a very different reason. Namely, he doesn't have it. Benjamin is author of American Nerd and the upcoming novel Good Kids. He's also director of creative writing at Southern New Hampshire University. Benjamin, thanks for joining us on Word of Mouth.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
How old are you when you were diagnosed?
Well, you know, I was sitting at the table with my mom when I was 17. My mom was a psychologist who thought a lot about Asperger's. And we went through the DSM definition, if I remember correctly. And I said, oh, well, that sounds like me. And I think that was when it was more or less settled in her mind, or began to be settled in her mind.
What kind of symptoms did you say yes to on the checklist?
Well, the symptoms are pretty vague, so a lot of people could say yes to them. But I had intensive interests, which included playing guitar in my room and listening to music and reading. And I wasn't very good at making friends. I had a few friends, but not very many. I wasn't a recluse, but I was, you know, not a popular kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really what qualifies you to have Asperger's in the DSM-4, which is still the rule that people have, is essentially a lack of social skill and intense interests.
Mm-hmm. And your mom, who was a researcher at the mm-hmm. time, or very interested in what was going on in the world of Asperger's, you appeared in a film, in fact, mm-hmm. one of these short film strips of mm-hmm. you know, information about Asperger's. How did you react to that diagnosis? Did you think, oh, okay, this explains everything? You know, was it kind of liberating, validating? Did you kind of embrace it?
No, I mean, I don't think I understood what Asperger's syndrome was very well until my mother actually showed me the educational video she had made. And then when I saw the other subjects who were being interviewed, I was immediately like, what? It was that kind of reaction because they were very obviously mildly autistic. They would kind of spout information about sea creatures, for example, at length. And I was pretty sure at that point that that wasn't me.
Well, do you think your mother's occupation kind of led her in that direction? Or, you know, I mean, I think a lot of parents have anxiety if their kids are not normalized in the sense that maybe they have ideas of.
Sure. You know, it's so hard for parents right now because we're in a place with our understanding of the human mind where we don't really know whether something's neurologically based or socially based. You know, that is whether you're unpopular just because you're in high school and you're kind of weird looking and into unconventional things, or if your neurology is actually different from other people's. And so I think parents are constantly trying to walk this very wavy, thin path between acknowledging if a child is neurologically different from most other children on one hand and overdiagnosing on the other hand.
So when did you realize that you'd been overdiagnosed, that you did not really have Asperger's syndrome?
I think it was when I saw that video. You know, also, like most people, I grew up a lot between ages 17 and 22. And so I think maybe once I'd sort of established myself in New York City and met other people who were more like me, then I also came into a greater sense that it wasn't that I had a neurological condition that made it hard for me to find friends. It was that I hadn't moved to New York yet.
Yeah. You're now the author of a book called American Nerd. Now, that, you know, you probably met a lot of people in New York who were sort of a lot like you. Is there an overlap, do you think, between these kind of elements of, you know, geek culture, as it's called, and the current criteria for Asperger's?
You know, there's a lot of overlap between a kid who has intense interests and somebody who might be diagnosable as mildly autistic. And I think the difference is that a kid who understands what's going on with social interaction but still isn't popular should not be diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. The distinction should be whether you fail to understand what's going on socially and therefore can't make friends, can't be socially competent, so to speak.
Well, let's talk about that diagnosis because it's created huge ripples in the neurological and Asperger's study and autism study communities. The proposal for the DSM-5 it recommends folding Asperger's into what they call autism spectrum disorder, which would change the criteria for the diagnosis. This is Danya Jekyll. She's director of the Asperger's Association of New England talking about it.
People are concerned that if there's no Asperger's syndrome, they're going to lose that diagnosis and they're going to lose their identity, their service, and their community. 18, 20 years ago, when there was a diagnosis of autism and there was no diagnosis of Asperger's, there were many, many families who were extremely isolated. They had children who were struggling, but there was no place for them. There was no community for them. The parents felt alone. They didn't understand how to parent. There were no resources. And we feel that the changes to the DSM-5, the proposed changes, could bring us back into the time when there were really no services, no community, no help for those folks with Asperger's syndrome. And we really don't want to go back in time.
Well, Benjamin, you talked a little bit about what you think the distinction should be. You know, not just social awkwardness, or maybe an awareness of social awkwardness, I guess, would be kind of the barometer. Listening to what Danya was just talking about, I mean, this is a much larger issue. You went through this personally. You probably have an acute awareness of what's going on sort of politically or in the research community. Any thoughts on what she said?
Yeah, I think it is really important for people who are on the autism spectrum to have communities and to have services. And she makes an incredibly valid point. No kid who has mild autism should go untreated. And that's one of the reasons why I say very explicitly in my Times op-ed page that the intentions of my mother and her colleague were incredibly noble, that there's very important work to be done in destigmatizing Asperger's syndrome and autism spectrum disorders of all kinds, and in building communities and creating services for people who have it. What's also important, however, and I think this is less talked about, is that the current outlines of what Asperger's syndrome is are so vague that we don't really understand what we're talking about when we talk about Asperger's, that we don't understand typically when you and I say to each other over lunch, oh yeah, that guy's kind of Asperger's-y, what we mean. You know, it's really entered pop culture, and it's become part of our lexicon, and people throw it around without any understanding of what they're saying or any consensus as to the real definition. And so it seems to me that the diagnosis probably should be modified in such a way so that there can still be a community, there can still be services for people who are on the autism spectrum, but it's defined so precisely that any old nerd isn't an Aspie.
Benjamin Nugent is director of creative writing at Southern New Hampshire University and author of American Nerd, The Story of My People. His upcoming novel is called Good Kids. You can find more on Benjamin and the proposed changes to the DSM-5 at wordofmouthradio.org. And we'd love to know what you think. Do you have a social anxiety in need of a diagnosis? Is there a risk of diagnosing basic human traits and giving them some sort of pathology? You can share your thoughts with the rest of us. Send a tweet to @wordofmouth or join the conversation on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Coming up, you thought Alvin and the Chipmunks had talent? We'll learn about the musicianship of mice when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott with a story that we found pretty astonishing. Humans are not the only mammals who can carry a tune. Research at Duke University reveals that the humble mouse, so plentiful in science labs, also has a penchant for singing, and singing in tune. Producer Taylor Quimby, our ever-eager investigator of strange science and clamoring beasties, reports.
When it comes to mice, there's a difference between a squeak and a song, and that difference has everything to do with vocal learning.
Vocal learning, you know, as I grew up as a scientist, is considered pretty rare.
Eric Jarvis is an expert on vocal neurobiology at Duke University.
Of the 28 orders or so of birds, it's convincingly found in three. That's the parrots, songbirds like your mockingbird, and incidentally, hummingbirds. And then in mammals, of course, us humans, dolphins, bats was shown in the 1990s, and recently elephants imitating truck sounds.
Historically, mice have been considered, in a sense, tone deaf, like macaques, pigeons, or chickens. These are animals for whom a squawk is a squawk is a squawk.
That meant that they couldn't imitate anything at all, and they didn't have any forebrain pathways that was involved in controlling vocalizations.
But as it turns out, mice have more in common with songbirds than previously thought. In testing for vocal learning, Jarvis and his team looked for several key factors. First, do mice have an area of the forebrain that's active when they make sounds?
And we actually found that in mice. And that was our first discovery. That actually kind of shocked us because we were just trying to prove that it wasn't there.
Second, does that area of the brain connect to muscles that control the larynx? Again, the answer was yes, but there was a difference.
Mice had a very sparse projection, like one or two connections per cell, whereas humans and songbirds have many, tens to hundreds of connections per cell.
But their most interesting discovery was this. Mice are capable of matching pitch. Say two male mice are put in a cage. The smaller of the two sings high.
Squeak.
The larger of the two sings low.
Squeak.
Now put a third mouse, a female, into the cage, and the smaller male mouse starts singing at the same pitch as the larger male.
Squeak.
That's pitch matching, or our best approximation. You see, mice sing at an ultrasonic pitch too high for the human ear. Jarvis isn't sure what the mice are singing about or why, but he does say the study has changed our assumptions about vocal learning.
Vocal learning, we don't think, is a black and white world. Even the evolution of speech, it's not like you have it and you don't have it. What we think is that it's more a continuum or a spectrum of traits.
Jarvis thinks we may have dismissed other animals capable of vocal learning because they're not as far along the spectrum as, say, parrots or dolphins or humans. In other words, most animals aren't going to win American Idol, but it doesn't mean they can't keep a tune. So, what's next? For now, Jarvis wants to learn more about his singing mice. He hopes to find genetic evidence of their vocal learning and look for ways to push their vocal abilities even further. Well, probably not that far. For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
If you've never heard of Ingrid Michaelson, don't worry. Chances are you've heard her music, maybe on an Old Navy sweater commercial.
The Fair Isle Sweater Collections.
Or on a television show like One Tree Hill, Army Wives, or frequently, Grey's Anatomy.
His grandmother's picture was by the bed. His lucky scrub cap was hanging on the door.
Ingrid's accessible and emotional indie pop music has made her a go-to for soundtrack supervisors, and since built her a grassroots army of fans devoted to each of her five studio albums. The latest is called Human Again.
Do you remember when the walls fell? Do you remember the sound that the door made when you closed it on me?
Ingrid Michaelson is on an international tour which returns for a series of sold-out shows in the U.S. in early December and a concert at Lincoln Center in March. We caught up with Ingrid from the road and asked her what it is about her songs in particular that so often make the soundtracks of television dramas.
I don't really know, but what I would venture a guess, I would say that they're melodic. I mean, I grew up watching old musicals. I never really listened to the radio until I was 13. My influences were like Judy Garland and, you know, old Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye movies. And so I think that my music tends to have a very melodic bass at the core of it. And I have a pretty voice. I don't know. I don't know. Who knows?
Well, obviously, it got on the right desks or in the right inboxes of the right people.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I put up a few of my songs on MySpace, and this licensing company that I still work with approached me and said, we're looking to sign unsigned artists to our licensing company, and I was very unsigned. I said, yeah, that would be great. And then 2 months later, they got me my first placement on Grey's Anatomy, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
Social media in action, I guess.
Yeah.
I was following a discussion a couple months ago, and this was with the Black Keys, a band that sold a lot of songs to car commercials in particular. And, you know, whereas at one point that may have been considered selling out, they said, we don't have a problem with it. It allows us to make more music. So how about you? What's your thought on, is it commercializing your music, whether it be for TV shows or advertising?
That Old Navy clip you played, that was from 2007. And when that happened, there weren't that many people licensing their music to commercials at the time. So I got a very heavy downpour of, you've sold out, you're selling out. And this is while I was, you know, living in an apartment with cockroaches and mice in a bad part of Brooklyn. You know, I didn't see it that way. I still don't see it that way. I think in a world where many people are illegally downloading music and are file sharing, how do you expect a musician to make a living? So I think that more than half the people that are saying the Black Keys are selling out or that I'm selling out are the ones that are probably illegally downloading our music anyway. So maybe they should take a look at themselves.
Well, let's get back to the music because that's what it's all about. There's a track from your latest album. This is called This Is War.
It's a wonder it all. It's a wonder. It's a wonder. Your
it's very recognizably you, so not, you know, a complete departure from previous albums, nor is it the same. It sounds a little more produced, a little darker to me. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of making the album? Were you going for something different?
Yeah, I was. I think a lot of my previous work, while I wouldn't say that it's all little ditties and things like that, but I think that a lot of the songs that actually ended up making it out into the world in terms of being on the radio and being used in commercials and such were of the nature of being called cute, mm-hmm. I suppose you could mm-hmm. say. So on this record, I just didn't really want to go there again. I felt like the ambassadors of my music had been these, you know, not quite representational songs. And so I figured, well, on this record, I'm not going to give anybody a chance to pigeonhole me again. And so I purposely didn't, but also I don't think I'm there in my life at this point anymore to feel like I'd want to write a song like that. So as much as I can say it was intentional, I think it came from within, you know.
If you knew me, would you save that seat for me?
And we'll leave you with Blood Brothers from Ingrid Michaelson. Her new album is called Human Again. Ingrid, thank you so much for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks so much.
Singer, songwriter, and frequent TV soundtrack contributor Ingrid Michaelson. She's currently on a mostly sold-out tour, but you can look for show dates and watch videos of the commercials and television scenes that have made her voice so familiar. The links are at wordofmouthradio.org.
If you love me, would you hold on to my hand? If you love me, would you finally understand?
Up next, another voice that we're willing to wager you've heard. We'll meet Tom Kane, the unbelievably game and funny man behind thousands of movie trailers, documentaries, and more. That's when Word of Mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. And here at Word of Mouth, we frequently crack wise about bizarre stories by imitating that ubiquitous announcer voice from movie and game trailers. You know, the one that always begins with, in a world.
In a world. In the year 2017.
In a time of tradition.
In a city where anything can happen. In a war that isn't his.
One day we thought, who does that? Let's find that guy. And we did. Tom Kane is the voice of the Academy Awards, dozens of video game characters, cartoon characters on the Smurfs, South Park, Powderpuff Girls, and hundreds of others. He's been the voice of JFK, Yoda, and of movie trailers from Pixar's WALL-E to, of all things, Booty Call.
Booty. Fleshy, rounded loads. A little something something.
Can I get some?
Call.
Excuse me?
An invitation.
Let's get ready. To lure.
Booty, round, fleshy globes. I
went through this strange period back then, and that was whatever that was, late 80s, early 90s, or something like that, where for some reason, they, meaning the trailer people in Hollywood, decided I was going to start being the voice of all these black comedies. And I must have done like a dozen, every Wayans movie that came out, you know, in the mid-80s was me, you know, and it was all, you know, starring Damon Wayans. And, you know, I'm like, okay, this is, you know, 27-year-old white guy. I'm going to be the voice of black comedy in America.
How many people do what you do?
Well, it depends on what area of voiceover work you're talking about. If you're talking about commercials, there are, you know, thousands of people that do commercials. When you're talking about the other end of the scale, though, movie trailers, for instance, there are about, 20 of us.
Really?
Yeah, maybe 25 that do almost all the movie trailers in the United States. It's a, you know, people ask quite often, they're like, you know, how do I get into movie trailers or how do I get into animation, which, you know, I would say there are less than 100 people that do almost all the cartoon roles in the United States. So, you know, I tell people it's numerically, it's easier to get into the NBA yeah, than it is, you know, cartoons or movie trailers. So,
how did you start there? Did someone in the industry say, oh, my, you have a lovely deep voice. You should do movie trailers.
No. I'm the only person I know that got into it the way I did. Almost everybody else that's in professional voiceover work came to it either from acting, on-camera acting, or from, you know, radio. I actually started doing voiceover work when I was 15 years old.
Whoa.
I was just bored. It was summertime. And I lived, I'm in Kansas City. And I just thought it'd be fun to hear myself on the radio. It didn't occur to me anybody actually got paid for it. And all the local ads were, pretty horrible, because they were usually the owner, the owner's son, or some local FM disc jockey. So they all sounded, this yeah. Saturday, at the Waterbed Gallery. So I started calling up, the local ad people. But one day I called, it was the American Cancer Society, and I said something to the effect that, your commercial sounded terrible. And about an hour later, I got a phone call from probably the largest ad agency in Kansas City at the time. And they thought I was an adult and a professional voiceover guy. So I had my dad drive me down to the studio because they didn't have a license. And of course, they walk up to him and start talking to him. And he's like, no, that's the pimply face kid in the fringy cutoff jeans is the who you were talking to. And anyway, I recorded it and I did it in a character voice, and it was a big hit. And within a week, the same ad agency hired me to do 5 Screen Actors Guild, union spots, and I was off and away.
I'm actually reading a list of the accents you do. You talked about character voice. British, American, Irish, Scottish, German, French, Italian, Russian, Swedish. Need I go on? Oh, Texan, New England. Let's hear what New England sounds like, Mr. Tom Kane.
Well, that's funny you should mention that, because that was actually what I did for that very first commercial.
No kidding.
And it was funny because what happened was is the poor guy who had called me for that thing was getting his butt chewed by the producer. Because they had to rent this studio, and he's trying to explain that this kid is who they brought in. They've rented a studio. And in the middle of all this, I say, do you want this in some kind of accent? I didn't know the term dialect. He goes, what? And I said, I think it would sound good as the old Pepperidge Farms guy. And he hits the talk bag, goes, oh, you can talk like a 70-some-year-old man from New England, can you? And I'm like, well, yeah, sure. I mean, can everybody? And he said, well, let's hear that. So I read the script through, and the engineer looked up and he said, that was 29 seconds on the nose. Every weekend, a couple dozen Kansas City families have a couple dozen garage sales. But on July 1st and 2nd, 1,000 Kansas City families are going to have just one garage sale. Oh, God, I still remember it.
You do still remember it. That's so impressive.
You never forget your first. You never forget your first commercial. So, very weird.
Well, it's so funny to talk to you because I feel like I'm talking to somebody I know. We've heard your voice in so many different contexts. Let's hear some examples of the many voices of Tom Kane.
Live from the Kodak Theater at Hollywood and Highland in Los Angeles, California, the 78th Annual Academy Awards.
They are the killing fields of Saddam Hussein, the mass graves unearthed since the fall of his regime.
On March 31st, see the most epic comedy in 2 million years.
Hello, Dave. You're looking well today.
So that's Tom Kane as announcer for the Academy Awards, National Geographic documentary narrator Hal in a Mac commercial in, 2000, I think it was.
Yeah.
How do you prepare for the differences in these kind of roles? I mean, is this kind of method for you? Do you...
Well, a lot of voiceover people really work at it. There are some people that literally will sit and do funny faces in a mirror to, figure out how to get different sort of sounds out of them. Partly because I'm lazy and partly because I'm too busy. I don't do that. I just don't. If I can do a voice or I can do a character, I do it. And if I don't, I don't. I'm just lucky that I'm a good mimic. I just recycle what I grew up hearing. Someone says, do an old, crusty old Western man. I give him, a little of this here sort of thing. These whippersnappers don't know it, but I'm, it's Walter Brennan. It's Gabby Hayes. And they think, I'm doing this funny. I'm like, nah, I'm just recycling something I heard when I was 5.
Well, is that what it is? Like someone says, do a Sean Connery, you'll watch a James Bond movie and you'll have it?
Well, that is what is just brilliantly wonderful about the modern era is people ask me to do that all the time for movie trailers. I actually am one of the guys in Hollywood. There's just a handful of us that they will hire to do celebrity sound-alikes, particularly for movie trailers, because like Sean Connery, actually, they needed a line. This is the very first time I started doing this for The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And he wouldn't do it because he and the director, I think they literally actually came to blows at one point on the script. But I had, because of the internet, you just you Google it and it's there, you know. But some of them just fall out of the sky. I mean, they, you know, I got a call a couple months ago and, you know, can you do Liam Neeson? And I'm like, I have no clue. So I went, found the junk, and sort of turns out I can. It's I don't know what you want. If it's money, I don't have any. But what I do have is a unique set of skills that makes me a nightmare for people like you.
Are you the guy, Tom Kane, who does the, in a world?
Oh, no. That was Don LaFontaine. Don and I were friends for so long. He actually was the man that sort of invented modern trailers. He was a young pup in New York, and he was a writer and a producer. And the voiceover guy didn't show up for the recording session one day.
Oh, the classic story.
Yeah. And Don said, you know, he had this sort of, you know, his natural voice was kind of down here like this. But back then, movie trailers didn't sound like that. Movie trailers back in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, it was like, see the spectacle, you know, the amazing, you know, oh, it was, It was not anything remotely like what we have today. And they just panicked. So they said, okay, well, let's rewrite this so there's only a few lines. And so it was for some horror movie. And he, you know, it was the first time anybody, instead of see the horror, it was, you know, just, you know, scary music and him going in the dark, you know, late at night and whatever. And it was a huge departure. But he is literally the guy with his own hand who penned In a World. And now, and, you know, he was the one that sort of invented that thing. But in 1986 or 7, when I started, Don LaFontaine by himself did half of all the trailer voiceovers.
Oh, my goodness.
In the United States. There's like six guys now. Don died a couple years ago, that basically have made an entire career out of just trying to ape Don LaFontaine. And none of them do it as good as Don, but they're good enough, and they, you know, they get that growl, you know, in the world. Yeah, I don't do that. I don't have those pipes. I don't, you know, most of these guys used to smoke like locomotives and still do. Most of, you know, the trailer stuff I do is more lighthearted. I do like most of the Disney Pixar things. You know, it's like, you know, it's Toy Story 3 starts Friday at theaters everywhere, you know.
But then what if you have to do something serious, like, you know, National Geographic, survival of the baby elephant? You know, how do you get yourself
there? Well, I do that. But, you know, that's not one of these things down here. It's more just, you know, when the baby elephant arrives at the pond, the alligators get very excited. You know, it's more just informational.
Well, when you're doing a voice like that, like, say, Yoda you do for Clone Wars, right?
Yeah, I've been doing Yoda for like a decade.
But are you worried about harming your pipes? Because it's hard to sustain,
yes.
Isn't it?
It is tough, but fortunately, Yoda never says much. You know, I mean, think about it. If you add up, you know, everything he said in all the movies, you could probably put it on one page. Hard on my throat it is, yes. But short are the lines. The only time I've had a problem with the Yoda stuff is on video games, because you have to allow for every possibility when you record. So if Yoda's telling somebody, in a movie, west you must go. In a video game, he has to go, west you must go, north you must go, east you must go, south you must go, northwest you must. I mean, you've got to record every possibility.
Is there anything you ever refused to do? You know, the sort of, I guess, vocal equivalent of the full frontal or something like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've kind of worked myself out of most video games, because it is too hard on the throat. There's just too much screaming and dying. And I don't do politics, and I don't do religions. I just kind of stay away from all that.
Good policy. Have you ever tried a public radio voice, Tom Kane?
A public radio? Well, those are usually very, very calm. You know, it's you know, coming up on NPR. All Things Considered, next on NPR. Very soothing.
Well, maybe it's hard to follow up, Tom Kane. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Tom Kane is the voiceover guy behind more than 30,000 movie trailers, commercials, cartoon performances, and video games, among other things. To hear more of his work and to see video and trailers from some of the characters we talked about, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for joining us today for some stories of how people create or put off creating or lend their voices and imaginations to our musical, sometimes educational, and often theatrical escapes.
In a world where every news story sounds like the most important thing you've ever heard in your life, word of mouth
covers ideas.
Well, we can hope. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth
from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie,
with web support from Sarah Plour.
Andrew Perella, that's me,
provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR.
Its board of trustees or its underwriters.
That's right.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
You can also follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.